This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some sounds from the week's top Granite State headlines.
I understand that no term of incarceration can restore them to their former health. No sentence of incarceration can take away their insecurity or undo the bewildering unfairness of what has happened to them. But I hope, I fervently hope, that bringing this defendant to swift and certain justice gives them some peace of mind as they confront the uncertainty of life with hepatitis C.
There's no doubt in our minds that this is the most important decision for the legislature in this upcoming session. There's no walking this one back.
I think it's important to point out that Robin Hooders weren't harassing or intimidating or threatening anyone. No evidence of that was presented during the 3 days of full court hearings in this matter.
Our contractors have been telling us that, listen, if nothing happens in this next session, we're going to have to start to look outside our state border, and we don't want to do that. And we're somewhat stuck in the middle. So we have the projects both on the highway fund side and the turnpike side. We just need to make sure that they get funded.
It's a difficult situation for these retailers, and now that people can shop online, they can basically shop from home on Thanksgiving Day. So, you know, if you're not open, you're going to lose out to Amazon.
From the top, that was U.S. Attorney John Kakavas on the sentencing of David Kwiatkowski, convicted of infecting dozens of patients with hepatitis C. Former State Senator Harold Janeway on his new role as head of an anti-gambling effort. Ian Freeman, one of Keene's so-called Robin Hooders, on the group's dual victory in court this week. New Hampshire Transportation Commissioner Chris Clement discussing the consequences of his budget shortfall, and Boston University marketing professor Barbara Bickert analyzing the Thanksgiving Day kickoff of the holiday shopping season this year. Although it's still early December, preparations for when state lawmakers return to session in January made headlines this week, and one issue that's sure to return with them is transportation funding. DOT Commissioner Clement this week said his department's financial situation had gone from crisis to catastrophe, and he painted dire pictures of unplowed roads and unfinished projects unless more money comes through. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. We want your thoughts about the headlines of the week. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Our guests for the roundup are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for NHPR. Josh, thanks for taking some time out for us.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Ben Lubsdorf, reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Ben, welcome back to you, too.
Good morning.
Well, Josh, I want to start with you and Transportation Commissioner Chris Clement. Again, as I said, going from crisis to catastrophe. What's he talking about there?
Well, he's talking about that the a number of things. I mean, the shortfalls in the highway fund, a $20 million annual deficit. Some of that is due to a loss of one-time money. That fund is the money that goes in is from the gas tax, about $120 million a year, another $110 million a year in auto registration. As you probably recall, there's been a debate and will continue about increasing the gas tax that stands at 18 cents. That hasn't been raised since 1991. There was an effort to raise it 12 cents last year, passed in the Democratic-controlled House, failed in the Republican-controlled Senate. Governor Hassan is open to looking at revenue options to increase transportation funding, hasn't come out hard and fast on anything, unlike Governor Lynch, who said he would veto gas tax when he was in there. You know, there are a lot of big projects out there. The 10-year highway plan is being revisited. One thing that Christopher Clement said this week that was interesting was that if absent more money, $250 million is needed to complete the widening of 93 between Salem and Manchester. That's going to grind to a halt in the fall of 2016. You know, in the near term, he's talking about not being able to plow the roads at the same rate, and transportation is expensive, and there are proposals that are going to be looking at raising money, and this is going to be one of the bigger issues to watch this second year.
Well, and I want to ask Ben about that, too, because he did a story on that. But, Josh, to you, Commissioner Clement painted a pretty dire picture. I mean, as you said, you know, the I-93 widening, grinding to a halt, you know, roads not getting plowed in a quick manner during this winter. What was the reaction there at the State House? Did people say, wow, this is terrible? Did people say that he was, you know, exaggerating for purposes of boosting his budget?
Well, this isn't a new message from him. This has been going on for some time, and he was invited in to speak to the House Public Works and Highways Committee chaired by David Campbell. He was the lead sponsor of that 12-cent gas tax. Representative Campbell and Commissioner Clement have been, you know, rather adamant that the state needs more money. And, you know, we'll see what the appetite is that among particularly Republican lawmakers. Senate President Chuck Morris has already come out against a similar position to he had last year, a gas tax increase. He preferred to fund a construction of roads and bridges with casino revenue. And so, you know, it's sort of back to the same debate last year. It looks like it's shaping up to be. And so we'll see where this goes.
Yeah. So as Josh said, Senate President Chuck Morris, Ben, is opposed to a gas tax increase. And if I'm correct, also to a toll increase. Is that right, Ben?
I believe so, though the toll increase actually goes through, I believe, the executive council, not the legislature. So he wouldn't have as much say on that. But this debate has been going on for years, and this past year, the debate was really presented for a lot of people as a binary. Do we get the money for transportation with a casino, with expanded gambling? That was the Senate's position. They passed their bill. The House's position was, let's raise the gas tax by 12 cents over time, 3 years for gas, 6 years for diesel. And both chambers killed the other's idea. In the Senate, it was quite lopsided, I believe, 18-6 against the gas tax, and they used a special procedural motion to really put it down and say we want to not consider anything similar next year. Now, what Senator Jim Rausch, who's a Dairy Republican, who chairs the Senate Transportation Committee, is coming forward with now is an idea, a bill that Chuck Moore says he will allow to be introduced in the Senate, which doesn't guarantee its passage, but it would raise the gas tax by linking it to inflation. This is an idea that two states already do, and Massachusetts will start doing in 2015, that you link the rate of your gas tax to the CPI, the measure of inflation. And for this, it would be the what's technically known as the CPIU for Brockton, Boston, Nashua, which is a boring way of saying it's the rate of inflation in this area. And initially, it would be the rate of inflation over the last decade. That would be about 4 cents in 2014. Going forward, every 4 years, the tax would automatically be adjusted based on the rate of inflation. So there would be no more votes, no more action needed from the legislature. It would put in place an automatic system that would keep the gas tax rising roughly on par with inflation. And Senator Rausch says he believes this is a logical approach, a reasonable approach. It's not a huge spike in the tax, but it will help restore the purchasing power that he says has been eroded over time. You know, it was 18 cents in 1991. It's 18 cents today. And obviously the dollar doesn't buy as much today as it did in 1991. So that we're getting the same rate, but much less purchasing power out of it.
Well, and let me invite our listeners to join us. And then, Dean, I want your thoughts on this as well, on this debate that Josh and Ben say we've been around on before. The number for you to join our New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Join us as we review some of the top stories of the week, including what we're talking about right now, New Hampshire's transportation commissioner having some dire predictions about his department's finances and his ability to complete projects. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean, what's the political take on this back and forth that we see again and again on transportation funding?
Right. And the issue is we're just about to enter into an election year, 2014. And for a lot of Republicans, tax increases, particularly in an election year, are anathema. And I think that's a big reason why we heard President Morris say that he's looking for a non-tax solution. So I think just kind of as a kind of a basic ideological sticking point, getting a lot of Republicans, particularly in the Senate, to sign on to a tax increase can be very difficult. You know, it may be a principled stand on their part, or it may be a function of election year politics. It could could be some of both, but I think that's going to be an issue. I think the concern is going to be if this devolves back into an either-or proposition, as Ben was talking about, in which you have to have either casino gambling or a tax increase on gas in order to deal with the situation with the roads and bridges. If that happens, so I think we may end up back in a place very similar to where we were this past session, in which the focus is on whether or not we're going to have casino gambling. So I'll be looking to see if senators or even members of the House come up with some other alternatives that kind of break us out of this, either casino gambling or a tax increase. But I think just as a rule, I think, it's an election year. It's going to be very difficult to get any kind of revenue increase like that through the state legislature.
Ben, do you want to jump back in?
And Senator Rausch actually acknowledged he doesn't want to put senators in harm's way in an election year. I think those were exact words yesterday. So he acknowledges that this is going to be a tough sell for a lot of Republicans. But as to that binary, Senator Rausch is emphasizing that he doesn't think it's either or. It should be either or. He thinks that these are a casino, expanded gambling, and an increase in the gas tax, a more modest increase than had been proposed last year, can work together to fund transportation projects. He says he still supports expanded gambling, and we're going to be seeing that debate.
He was one of the lead sponsors of the casino bill also, so he's, covering the waterfront on this topic.
Well, and if we could talk about the gambling just a little bit, guys, and Josh, to you. So this debate is also heating up, as all of you are saying. And just this week, anti-gambling forces unveiled new leadership. Who are they, Josh? What do they bring to the table?
Well, the Coalition Expanded Gambling and Casino Free New Hampshire sort of rolled out kind of dual bipartisan frontmen. Steve Dupree, former GOP chairman, Concord businessman, and Harold Janeway, Democrat of Webster, former state senator. Both those folks were active in the fight against the casino bill last year, and they were rolled out in large measure because former Coalition Against Expanded Gambling, Jim Rubens, is now seeking a seat in the U.S. Senate, and they said they're going to be targeting their efforts, and they stressed that it would be a targeted effort on legislators in the House where the gambling proposal failed last spring. So, the commission that was set up to look at creating a regulatory scheme for a possible casino is meeting. They're going to be issuing their final report December 15th, and we'll see what's in that. There have been votes taken, straw votes, suggesting that they're going to at least be envisioning a certain number of slot machines, up to 5,000, if that straw vote stands. And they're also going to be potentially revamping oversight over charitable gaming, which was a problem that was identified during their work.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Join us as we remember the life of South African President Nelson Mandela with a special presentation this afternoon. We'll chart his struggles against apartheid and his legacies as head of state. We'll hear from friends and followers as well as the man himself in Mandela and audio history. That's this afternoon at 3 on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the Boston Pops Holiday Concert December 14th at the Verizon Wireless Arena, conducted by Keith Lockhart, with sing-alongs and Christmas classics. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. From Hinckley Allen, attorneys at law who believe a lawyer should also understand your business. More information about Hinckley Allen and the clients they serve is online at HinckleyAllen.com. And from Davies Tire Company, Islington Street in Portsmouth, dealers in Bridgestone Bluzac Tires and providing complete winter car care services, DaviesTires.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that have made headlines in the past week. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Some of the stories that we've been following have to do with old debates in the legislature, including the possible return of expanded gambling, continued discussion of a gas tax. Join us on those topics. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to also be looking at some of the political action as 2014 approaches. You can join us on that, too, if you want. Again, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Josh Rogers, Dean Spiliotis, Ben Loopsdorf. Let's go to our listeners now. And Eric's calling from Franconia. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I understand that these projects are very expensive, and you know, it takes a lot of money to fund them. But there's no discussion about the real cost of the transportation budget and the amount that goes into benefits and employees' wages in an agency that's just hugely, hugely, I feel, overemployed. It's a huge agency with a lot of there's a lot more people working there, I feel, than really need to be employed. It's a tough question and a hard thing to deal with, but I mean, I see it all the time. I work in the private sector working with the Agency of Transportation, and the work that I do myself alone takes, you know, 3 Department of Transportation employees to do. So
some efficiencies before you start raising gas taxes, is that what you're saying, Eric?
Way efficiency, and people talk about that all the time, whether it's at the local municipal level or at the state level. I mean, it's almost kind of a joke when you see employees hanging around on the side of the road in the orange trucks. You know, it's kind of like, you know, what's orange and sleeps for? You know, and I don't mean to be so cynical about it, but it is truly the fact that the agency employs way more people than it really truly needs.
All right, let's pick up on that point. Yeah, Eric, thanks a lot for calling in. And I just want to also add into Eric's point an email that we got from Curtis, who says middle class wages don't go up based on inflation. How are we supposed to pay for new taxes if we just don't have the money? Wages have dropped. The cost of everything keeps going up. Please stop bleeding the middle class. So Dean Spiliotis here, we're hearing from Curtis and from Eric. You know, hey, we can't afford this. And by the way, Eric says, let's cut some fat at DOT.
Yeah, well, and from the email that you just read, you get a sense of what the political pressure is on the demand not to raise taxes within the state, although there is a debate about that as well. It's interesting, you know, Eric's comments about, working for greater bureaucratic efficiencies. There is a political cost to that as well. One of the items that Clements mentioned was having to potentially lay off DOT workers. So then that in itself becomes another political issue because you don't want to be laying people off. It's problematic. I mean, I think we're going to see the legislature work very hard on this to come up with some sort of a solution. But it's a difficult issue. And again, I think if we fall back into the taxes versus casino debate, we may end up in the same place that we were at last spring.
Josh.
Well, it was an interesting point that Commissioner Clement made. Was he said, you know, if we cut workers in order to make the in order to reserve the money to save widen I-93, we may end up with the money to widen I-93 and a shortfall of engineers to actually make that happen. So that seems to be what we're going to hear from DOT in response to this. But, you know, lawmakers are going to be looking hard at, you know, how to get the ends to meet.
Ben?
And this issue of whether there is fat to cut at DOT was one of the sort of side debates of the gas tax this year. The issue of whether so-called diversion of the gas tax money should be ended. This is using money to pay for state troopers on highways. But I think there's broad agreement among most state officials that there is a serious problem, a serious shortfall in transportation infrastructure that needs more revenue to solve it. The question is, where does it come from?
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Jillian in Hudson. Go ahead, Jillian, you're on the air.
Hi, I just kind of want to say the opposing view on the gas tax. I think it's actually a really great way to raise revenue because, you know, it really helps people think about, how much they're driving. And I think that we need to really look at how much we're driving and how efficient our cars are because, you know, global warming is a huge issue that could cost us a lot of money down the road in dealing with the environmental consequences. And I think that it's a really good way to raise money for needed projects and also, on the other hand, to help the environment and make people think about their gas usage.
Jillian, thanks a lot for the call. This gets to what you were saying, Dean. This political pressures on both sides of this.
Right, Jillian. You know, we've been talking a lot about kind of the Republican case for not raising taxes. Jillian is providing the progressive argument in favor of energy conservation and greater efficiency, and people finding other ways to get around. We've talked occasionally about rail service in New Hampshire, and that has become a very ideologically charged issue as well. It's anathema to a lot of Republicans and a lot of progressives. think it's a big solution. But you know, the irony is that, you know, part of the problem is that cars are much more efficient now than they were 20 years ago. So you're not buying as much gas. And so that's one of the reasons why the revenue has slowed.
Jillian, thanks again for the call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Dean, back to you very quickly. I did want to get an update on a big story earlier this week. This was the sentence of David Kwiatkowski, convicted of infecting, several dozens of patients at Exeter Hospital here in New Hampshire and in a couple other states. Just remind us how terrible and how widespread this crime was, Dean.
Yes, this is you know, obviously, so we've been hearing about this for a while now. It's a very very tragic story, and as you mentioned, the medical technician pled guilty and has been sentenced to 39 years in prison. The prosecution had been asking for 40 years, but the judge took 1 year off as kind of a symbolic gesture that there is mercy and leniency in sentencing, but it's still going to be 39 years. It was a very dramatic scene. It had a number of the victims were able to testify for as long as they wanted. They all talked about being sentenced to death or having life sentences, and he's only getting 39 years. But he did plead guilty, now I think we'll see if people can move on. But it's a very tragic case. And again, it involved, I think, upwards of maybe 8 states, because he was sort of a traveling technician.
Right. Well, and that's my last question on this, Dean. I mean, does this end the legal battles, or are there more to come against either the hospital, the company right. that was responsible for his employment? I mean, there are a couple layers
here. Yeah,
in a
sense, this is really just kind of the first step, is him admitting guilt and being sentenced to prison. But there certainly could be lawsuits against the hospital and all other kinds of civil actions as well. Absolutely.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. Josh, I wanted to kick off a political segment here with you and talk about the race against U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat, seems to be in a strong position right now. A couple Republicans, though, are contemplating or are planning to run against Senator Shaheen. They want to be the Republican nominee. A new entrant this week. Remind us who jumped in.
Well, a familiar one, Bob Smith. He served 2 terms in the Senate and 3 in the House from New Hampshire. He also briefly ran for president and briefly sought Senate seats in Florida. Kind of full spectrum conservative he has a house in Tuftonboro now, was from Wolfboro. He's 72 years old, not terribly popular across the board in the Republican Party. As you may recall, in 2002, Republicans recruited, John Sununu, then congressman, to run against him. And Sununu won the primary and, went to Washington for a term. It's hard to, 2 months ago, Bob Smith says he wasn't going to run. He's a mercurial fellow and he is a nice sort of bearish man, very conservative and, with a sense of theater that will make this race interesting should he follow through and run. But it does raise the larger question of who's going to make it through that primary. We have Jim Rubin's, Karen Testerman, and Bob Smith. A lot of Republicans I talked to consider that sort of a motley assortment that might not come up with a victory. Former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown continues to hover, and people are waiting to see what he does. But certainly Bob Smith adds a lot of color and experience to the race. There are a lot of people I talked to who would be surprised if he actually ends up running, despite saying that he is running, given his track record.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about Scott Brown. I like your verb choice, hovering. Flirting is another word that's been used, Ben Lubsdorf. What did Scott Brown do this week?
Well, Scott Brown is still around. He is still, as he has been for the last, 8 months or so, attending a lot of GOP events in the state. He was in Londonderry for a fundraiser yesterday. He is now going to be headlining the holiday fundraiser for the state Republican Party. And last night he was a little more expansive than he's been in the past, telling reporters that he hasn't made a decision. He's keeping his options open. That's, not actually saying anything at all. Actually, more than he's been saying for months about whether he'll run for the seat, certainly keeping that option open. But just to illustrate one of the potential pitfalls of this, he would be switching states, which people are going to be using the word carpetbagger, and he will have to overcome that if he makes that run while speaking to reporters last night, and it was caught on video for everyone to see. He was talking about how he's talking to the people here in Massachusetts, and he got most of the way through the word Massachusetts before he caught himself and said New Hampshire. And it's a slip of the tongue. We all do it. But if you're thinking about switching states to run for the U.S. Senate in a new state, you probably should not mix up those two states. And I think that is going to reinforce the case that Democrats will make, certainly if he runs, that Scott Brown is an opportunist crossing the border. On the other hand, you look at some of the reaction to Bob Smith getting in this week from the GOP establishment, words like quirky, words like erratic, words like craven being thrown around. This is pretty harsh language from leaders, operatives in his own party. So I think there's certainly an opening for Scott Brown if he wants it.
Well, and there was a big deal made earlier this week, Dean, about Scott Brown changing his Twitter handle.
Right. He dropped the Scott Brown MA to just be Scott Brown. You know, Ben is right. I think he's going to face a potential carpetbagger problem. We don't know how big it's going to be. Some people say that, well, a lot of the Republicans living along the Massachusetts border, they don't have a big issue with that because of the proximity. He also is someone, it goes to show you how big his victory was in Massachusetts when he won the Senate, because became a national figure. His truck crosses the border into New Hampshire, and at least a half dozen national political websites put up a story about him being in New Hampshire. I haven't seen a lot of data. We had some data several months ago from WMUR that showed that for a lot of people, I think it was like somewhere in the 60% range, have an issue about him not being from New Hampshire. That may change. There's been one or two polls mentioned that showed that he may actually be competitive with Gene Shaheen. He'll certainly bring a lot of national attention and outside money, but the issue again is going to be whether or not he's viewed as a carpetbagger. That said, he may be a reasonably good ideological fit for where the Republican Party in New Hampshire is right now. You can't say that about Bob Smith. And, you know, Bob Smith, the interesting question for me, given everything else that people have said, is he's been out of the scene for 10 years here in New Hampshire. It's a very different political world here now in terms of the demographics, in terms of sort of the median voter. It's all changed quite dramatically. And I have no idea if he's going to be able to get back in step with that. And there is a lot of residual issues with him in the Republican Party, both for the Sununu primary in 2002 and for when he ran for president in 2000. He left the Republican Party, went to the Taxpayers Party, then became an independent, and then eventually, when he realized he could chair a Senate committee, went back into the Republican Party. So there's still a lot of kind of negative feelings about that.
Josh?
Well, I mean, it is interesting. When I was reading up about Bob Smith, I was curious about how long – I mean, it's Elian Gonzalez's 20th birthday today, as a matter of fact.
Remind us.
Well, I mean, he was a young boy from Cuba. His mother died on a boat when they were trying to get to Florida. The tug of war between whether he'd remain in the United States or whether he'd return to Cuba, where his father lived, was an issue that Bob Smith championed at length. Bob Smith's been out of it for a long time. He hasn't won an election since 1996. But on the Scott Brown front, people say that, you know, he's potentially warming to a race if he believes it's going to be a referendum on a so-called Obamacare. This is something that he, you know, ran against before, and this, you know, if that's the national issue, then that might be something that he could do. There's no doubt that Democrats view him as, you know, a real headache and a formidable challenger. The amount of money he can raise, and he could campaign potentially in a different way here than any of the other people in the race.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We're looking at some of the top headlines of the past week, and we want to hear from you. Some of the stories we'll be covering in just a few minutes. We'll be looking at the 2nd Congressional District. A new Republican has entered that race. Also, an update on the race for governor here in New Hampshire. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Later on, some good news for Granite State equestrians about their use of trails, and some good news for the Robin Hooders in Keene. They won a victory in court. We'll be talking about all those stories in just a moment, and we'd love your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. Christopher in Manchester sent in an email. He says, the state has changed a lot since Bob Smith held office. Christopher says his brand is much too extreme for present-day New Hampshire. Ben Lubsdorf, what do you think?
Well, I think that's going to be certainly the hit on Bob Smith. The Democrats have already started, and I think Bob Smith comes into this race with a real chance of winning the Republican primary if there's no other candidates who get in.
Scott Brown
doesn't jump in, because he's just better known than, even having not been in the state for 10 years, he's still better known than Karen Testerman or Jim Rubens, the two other candidates who have filed. That said, Scott Brown, if he gets into the race, you got him. There was a poll a few months ago that showed he would really dominate a Republican primary. I don't know if that's still true, how accurate that is, but you can see Scott Brown coming into the race and immediately starting to run a general election campaign against Jean Shaheen, whereas any of these other three candidates would have to start off focusing on the primary, seeking to win the primary, and that's a much more conservative electorate in an off-year Republican primary than it is in the general election.
Two other quick political stories that I want to make sure we get to. Dean Spiliotis, in the 2nd Congressional District, Marilinda Garcia, a Republican, announced plans to run against Congresswoman Ann McClain Custer. Now, we've talked about Representative Garcia before. Just remind us, give us a little bio, and then there was some flap about her entrance into this race.
Absolutely. She's a Republican from Salem. She's about 30 years old. I think she's in her fourth term in the state house. She is someone who has gotten a lot of press recently. The Republican National Committee at its meeting in Boston labeled her a rising star, and she's gotten a lot of attention within the national party as, you know, she's half Latino. I think she's Italian and Latino, so she has sort of an interest in Hispanic and Latino politics, which will resonate in the party, and she's considered conservative. She's gotten a lot of attention in the conservative media, and there was this flap recently. Manchester Democratic Representative Peter Sullivan got on Twitter and referred to her as a combination of Bill O'Brien and Kim Kardashian, which is a very silly comment, and he took it down, has sort of refused to really apologize, but it gives you kind of a sense of how nasty that race is going to be. You know, I, right now, the only other person in that second CD on the Republican side is Gary Lambert, who is a retired colonel. She's going to bring a lot more energy and excitement and name sort of recognition because of her status as this rising star than might otherwise have been the case. That said, Andy Custer, for whatever issue she's had with her favorability recently, you know, she's in her district that favors her a little bit, and she's also going to be able to bring in a lot of outside money. But Garcia is someone that people have been watching for a while.
Well, real quick, Dean, Gary Lambert also running in the 2nd Congressional District. George Lambert so far is the only Republican running for governor.
That's right. And we had a Brad Cook, a Manchester attorney, who said he would not take the pledge as a Republican, which a lot of people saw as being an impossibility, has said he's not going to run. So Hassan right now has no serious opposition.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and keep taking your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Healthcare.gov sees an enrollment jump after repairs to the troubled website. And fast food workers across the country protest the federal minimum wage. Then Vice President Biden urges restraint from China over an airspace dispute. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Rudy Group, serving successful families and businesses with sophisticated planning and investment management for over 30 years at UBS Financial Services, member FINRA SIPC. And JobsInNH.com, connecting New Hampshire employers with local qualified job seekers. JobsInNH.com, how New Hampshire gets to work. Online at JobsInNH.com. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, growth in the use of solar power in New Hampshire and nationally. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and join us Monday morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join our conversation now with a phone call, 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We want your questions and comments on some of the top stories of the week that we've been talking about, whether it's people getting ready to jump into the elections of 2014, efforts to possibly bring back casino gambling here in New Hampshire, and renewed efforts, as we've heard from our guests, to raise the gas tax here in the Granite State. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Ben Lubsdorf, I did want to ask you about the continued fallout from the Affordable Care Act, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield being the only provider so far in the state to participate in what are called the healthcare marketplaces. These are the online marketplaces where people are supposed to be able to shop around for coverage. And as you know, Ben, Anthem is the only one operating on this. It offered a narrow network of providers in order to lower costs. Those hospitals not included were upset. One of them took action this week to find out why they weren't included. What happened?
Well, and this is the issue of the narrow network, that 16 of the 26 acute care hospitals in the state are included in the network. That is, if you buy a plan from Anthem through the exchange, through the marketplace, your network that you get the in-network costs are those 16 hospitals. So it doesn't include Concord Hospital, and it doesn't include Frisbee Memorial Hospital. And the CEO there, Al Felgar, has been very vocal over the last few months over his exclusion, his hospital's exclusion from this network, and had threatened to take action, had threatened legal action. Now he is renewing his push to get access to basically the decision, how it was made to keep his hospital out of the network. He's been saying over and over again that he just wants a shot at getting into this network, just wants a shot at the rates that other hospitals are getting, at getting these patients who will be, presumably if there's patients going to Frisbee now and they get a plan through the exchange, they'll be going someplace else. And he doesn't want to lose that business. And his business concerns for his hospital are meshing quite well with broader Republican concerns about Obamacare in general, and I think broader concerns in the state about access to health care, regional access to health care, given this narrow network.
Yeah, Dean, I'd love your thoughts on this, too. We talked to the head of Anthem here in New Hampshire, and she said, look, you can't back out of these deals and start changing them around. Once you sign them, people sign on to them with the understanding that they will have the exclusive right to serve patients in that area. You can't change it once it's sealed.
That's right. And there's sort of a complicated set of economic issues that affect access to health care, the cost of health care. One of the reasons why these providers are increasingly moving towards narrower networks is to have greater efficiencies and lower cost. The political component to this, as Ben sort of alluded to, is this idea of, as President Obama said, if you want your doctor, you can keep your doctor. So it's become both a kind of an economic and political debate, the broader issue being this issue of whether or not Obamacare will actually improve access to health care and lower cost, or if, as some people are finding out, for some people who don't get subsidies, it may actually cost them more. But the argument is, well, you're getting a broader array of services. So this is an economic debate. It's a political debate. And this narrowing that's happened with Anthem in New Hampshire is something that we're seeing in other states as well. But from people I've talked to in the healthcare industry, that's kind of the direction of the future, increasingly sort of narrow networks as a means of controlling cost.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. The number, 1-800-892-6477. And I want to turn to a story in western New Hampshire. And Josh Rogers, this is in Keene, the so-called Robin Hooders won a victory in court against the city. What were they doing that caused the city to file suit?
They were filling parking meters on behalf of people who were parking. And then they were videotaping meter men and meter maids, and as they were making their enforcement rounds, and according to the meter attendants, they were harassing them, and the city had sought to create a 30-foot buffer zone protecting these officers, and court ruled that that's a unreasonable restriction on the so-called Robin Hooders of freedom of speech. A lot of the people, the so-called Robin Hooders, are sort of people members of or people aligned with the free state movement and sort of anarchist thought. And so and this has been there's tensions in Keene between law enforcement and people who want to live a unencumbered lifestyle. You can recall the so-called smoke-ins at the square there, people smoking marijuana or people smoking stuff that was, looked like marijuana, but they claim it wasn't. This is an ongoing issue in Keene. But the town is lost, and the so-called Robin Hooders are pleased, and they say that the allegations that they were harassing and threatening the meter attendants were, there was no evidence to suggest that, and it was never presented, and they feel exonerated, and we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
This is one of those great stories that illustrates the impact of social media and the internet. This is the kind of thing that would have been kind of a local, small local story of interest 20 years ago. Now, because of social media and the ability of kind of like-minded individuals to kind of find each other, this Robin Hood story, the smoke-in, all of this stuff is actually getting national attention from libertarian groups, from other groups. I've had calls from national media. Mother Jones called to talk about the politics of Keene. Now, that wouldn't have happened.
Wow.
There is national interest now because of social media in these kinds of test cases for libertarian politics. So we had it with the Bearcat. That story blew up into a national story among libertarians. Same kind
in
of
Concord,
thing.
Right.
In Concord, yes.
And this, it will be interesting to see if this issue dies down now that the weather's getting cold. That was one thing that sort of quelled some of the enthusiasm for smoking in the square when it gets too cold. You want to do it inside.
Ben, no thoughts from you on that. Okay. And I think Dean's right. This has been picked up not just by Mother Jones. I think I saw a New York Times article about what's been happening in Keene. So, all right. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Roger in Exeter. Hi, Roger. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I just want to make a comment on something I just heard. I keep hearing it about the Affordable Care Act, that those of us that are going to be forced to buy policies through the website are getting a broader range of benefits. And I keep hearing it from journalists, I hear it from commentators, I hear it from Democrats, and I've actually been into the website, I've taken a hard look at what I can buy, and I'm going to be forced to buy. I've talked to other small business people, and they've experienced the same thing. What we're being forced to do is pay a lot more money. And this broader array of benefits are many of them are benefits that I can say with 100% certainty I will never use. Because of my sex, I'm a male, I can't use maternity and prenatal care. I don't have children, but I'm being forced to pay for child vision and dental. Gastric bypass surgery, I do triathlons. I will never use that. So this broad array of benefits is a myth that I wish someone in in the journalistic outlets in the state, whether it's a newspaper or NPR, would do an investigation and say, well, what are these benefits? Because at the end of the day, those of us that are healthy are being forced to subsidize these benefits we will never use, may opt not to buy policies.
I have heard some talk about this. Roger, thank you very much for calling in. Dean Spiliotis, I have heard other people say, including on this station, look, why do I have to have this sort of mandated set of benefits under the Affordable Care Act when there's, 10 of them that I'm never, ever going to use?
Absolutely. And let me be clear here to the caller. When I said a broader array of benefits, all I simply meant was you're going to be paying for coverage in a wider range of areas that I'm agnostic on whether or not you want those or could use them. It's simply that you're required to have them, mental health, pregnancy, dental, all the kinds of things that Roger mentioned. So I'm not suggesting that it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just simply the case that you're going to pay more, but you're also going to be covered. Some people are going to pay more who aren't subsidized, but they're also going to be covered for more whether or not they actually need it. The argument there is that that's one way to reduce, to sort of kind of level the playing field in terms of health coverage and make overall cost of treatment lower because you have a lot more preventative services. If you have more preventative services in society, that will reduce the overall cost in the healthcare system. That's the argument. That's the argument that, as we heard, people are debating quite passionately. But it is a broader array of benefits that you're now required to have coverage for. Whether you want those benefits, that's a different story.
No, Roger, thanks a lot for the call. And Josh Rogers, to you real quickly, we talked earlier about candidates for state and federal office running here in New Hampshire. How much are we going to hear concerns like Roger's about the Affordable Care Act in these campaigns next year?
Well, I think we're already hearing a good deal of them. The life of these concerns, remains to be seen. There's no doubt that that this is an issue that Democrats are going to have to tackle. All of the Democratic members of the delegation voted on behalf voted for this. You can already see, Jean Shaheen's looking for ways to, she wanted to extend the enrollment period. You have Representatives Custer and Shea Porter sort of voting for a Republican-backed bill that would allow people to buy to keep their current policy for a year, and also people to buy in the individual market new policies that don't meet the specifications under Obamacare for another year. And Republicans are certainly see this as an issue that's going to make it a good year for them. It's kind of too early to know. It's certainly going to be out there. Whether it's something that the man on the street is talking about hugely, Election Day, we have no way of knowing. But if the problems with the website continue, we're going to be hearing a lot more about it. And certainly Democrats will say, "Oh, well, once the law starts to work, this is going to be less of an issue." We don't know at this point, but this is the apparent issue that's looming over this race. This could change between now and next year.
All right, let's take another call if we could. And Tina's calling from Laconia. Hi, Tina. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This past year, my husband and I had to drop our health insurance, which we had through Anthem, Blue Cross Blue Shield. We just couldn't afford it any longer. We were able to pick up. We were actually able to shop and sign up for insurance on the federal exchange yesterday. It took us 35 minutes. Lo and behold, it worked very well. However, at looking at the plans, it really felt as if, because there is no competition, that the insurance company is simply gouging. The premiums are far more expensive per month with higher deductibles. What we were previously paying $360 a month for, we had a $5,000 family deductible, and now the premium is well over $500 per month with an $11,000 deductible.
Wow.
It just feels like a case of insurance gouging.
Well, Tina, thank you for calling in. And so here, Ben, she got through on the exchanges, so she seems happy about that. But she's paying a lot more. You know, it's hard to assess anybody's individual situation on the air, but I'm wondering what you think about her point folded into what Josh said, the role that this is going to play in next year's elections in New Hampshire.
Well, I think Josh is right. We don't know yet.
Stories like Tina's, stories like Rogers.
Exactly. If these are still the stories that people are calling into the show with in October 2014, then I think Democrats are going to be pretty worried. I remember a few months back when the narrow network was first unveiled, when this was about to get up and running. Anthem came in and talked to the state senators who had expressed a lot of concerns about this narrow network, about these plans. They were explaining the premiums have to be higher because of a number of factors related with who's entering the pool. The rates that are being paid to hospitals are lower because that's bringing down costs otherwise, and that's why you need the narrow network. These are all business decisions that Anthem has made. But if you're just on the website shopping for insurance, you don't know that. You don't have the head of Anthem explain to you why they've made the decisions. Even if you did, you might not care. They're a big insurance company, and you're looking out for your family's situation. So I think if we have one positive story for every negative story, then it's going to be interesting to see where the chips fall.
Well, I did want to close out with a couple more items. And, Dean, to you, we should acknowledge the death of Nelson Mandela at the age of 95. Boy, lots and lots and lots of tributes and memories on the air today. Dean, I just wonder what reflections you have on Mandela's passing.
Yeah, well, for me, it took me back to my college years in the 1980s when people may remember the divestiture movement was a very big issue. The international community, particularly the United Nations, wanted strong economic sanctions on South Africa to end apartheid. That's what the Reagan administration wanted. That's what the international community wanted. What the Reagan administration instead did was called constructive engagement, which was to try to incentivize South Africa to phase out apartheid. So you had the sanctions versus construction engagement debate. On my college campus and most other college campuses around the country, there were a lot of protests. There was real pressure on college boards of trustees to divest any holdings and companies that were doing business in South Africa. I remember protests on my campus. I remember petitions in the dining center to pressure our board of trustees to get out of these companies that were investing. That song Sun City came out, Artists United Against Apartheid, to encourage entertainers not to perform in a white-only resort. facility. So it was a very tumultuous time that we just don't really hear about anymore. And then obviously I remember seeing Mandela walk out of jail in 1990. So he has kind of faded away in recent years in terms of being visible because of his health. But I remember very well, sort of one of my early introductions to politics as a young adult was this divestiture debate.
Right. I remember that too on college campuses around the country because we're about the same age,
exactly.
Dean. Yep. You know, one more news item that we do have to talk about, and it's one I don't want to talk about, but Ben Loupsdorf, you're heading on to wider pastures. We are going to miss you. This is a loss for the Monitor and for the loss for the News Roundup here at NHPR. Where are you going? What are you going to be covering?
Well, thank you. I'm going to be leaving the Monitor at the end of next week and moving down to Washington, D.C., my hometown, and going to be working for the Wall Street Journal, helping cover the economy and central banking. So I'm really excited for the opportunity. It's not easy to leave New Hampshire. Had a great run here.
Aren't you going to miss the legislature?
Oh, of course I'm going to miss the legislature.
All 424 of them.
Well, I was just thinking this week, I was covering the executive council, which they twice paused the meeting so that the governor could greet groups of fourth graders who were coming through the room and shake each of their hands. I'm thinking, no other state does this. No other state pauses fairly important state business so that children can be greeted by the governor. And that's something special about New Hampshire. I'll miss that.
All right. Well, when something big happens at the Federal Reserve or with our banking system, we're calling you.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. Congratulations, Ben.
Thank you.
That's super. Real quickly, Ben, and to you also, Josh and Dean, what are you going to be covering next week? I know you'll be packing up, Ben, but...
Well, we're done with the state budget. We're looking ahead to town budgets, but the county budget process is about to get started Wednesday. The Merrimack County delegation is going to get the first look at the 2014 budget. So that'll be something I'll be keeping an eye on.
Josh, how about you?
Well, things are kind of slow. I mean, certainly we'll be seeing if Scott Brown reemerges. He's coming to the Republican, the GOP Christmas party. He's going to be the keynote speaker. And also, this gambling bill is going to be out before the Christmas
break.
So we'll be looking at precisely what's in that.
Sure. Dean?
Yeah, the congressional races are getting increasingly interesting. And I'm also going to be watching that casino report because what initially was kind of focused on regulation now seems like it may be turning into kind of a pro-casino report, which would feed into then a new bill for legalization.
Okay. Well, and next week on The Exchange, we're going to be looking at solar power, also the new pope and some of the waves he's been making. We're also going to spend some time at the end of the week looking at how Granite Staters are feeling about the one-year anniversary of Newtown. So lots to talk about next week on The Exchange as well. Thank you all very much for coming in. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with how sold are we on solar? There are renewed hopes for this alternative energy, but also questions about its viability as a major power source. Then, Catholics reflect on Pope Francis, whose recent words provided fodder for many a Thanksgiving dinner conversation. And later, as we near the anniversary of the Newtown tragedy, we look at what's changed and what hasn't. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 9:58. Good morning. The domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from New Hampshire Catholic Charities, wishing a Merry Christmas to all. Catholic Charities, moving lives forward through education, counseling, and caring, dignified services, nh-cc.org. And Comcast Business, supporting New Hampshire Food Bank's collection of non-perishable food items at the New Hampshire for the Holidays Expo, December 7th and 8th. More at events, nh.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama remembered Nelson Mandela yesterday, calling himself one of millions influenced by the first black president of South Africa.
I am one of the countless millions who drew inspiration from Nelson Mandela's life. My very first